Attention, pleasure seekers. What if I told you there was a toy that was so iconic that it practically set the standard for all my favorite products? Allow me to introduce or reintroduce to you the Magic Wand. Dubbed the Cadillac of Vibrators, the Magic Wand is more than just a toy. It's a culture icon, a symbol of power and unapologetic pleasure. Do you know any other toys that have been praised in Time magazine? Didn't think so. With a unique rumble that resonates deep within, the Magic Wand Original is not just a product, it's a trusted confidant. And it's a sure thing. Never had an orgasm? Try a Magic Wand. Never given your party a full body massage? Try the Magic Wand. Listen, it's rightfully earned accolades like Vibrator of the Year for decades, and I've been obsessed with my Magic Wand. I even drilled holes in my bedside table so that she's always next to me in case I need her. Well, that was years ago, because now there are multiple iterations of the Magic Wand, allowing you to pick whatever model fits your lifestyle. You can go wireless with the Magic Wand Rechargeable, tiny with the Magic Wand Mini, or micro. Micro is really mini. Or go for variety with the Magic Wand Plush. The best part though, all of them have the same powerful orgasmic rumble that made the original so popular. So if you're ready to make some magic, visit sexwithemily.com/magicwand and discover why the Magic Wand continues to cast a spell on the world. Magic Wand, not just a vibrator, an icon of pleasure. Summer is definitely the sexiest season. I mean, think about it. The days are longer, the nights are hotter, and your sex life is too. And if you're looking to turn up the heat, how about a little help from our friends at Promescent? Summer is all about things hot and steamy, so I highly recommend you add something extra and tap into Promescent's lineup of pleasure-enhancing products. I've been singing their praises for years since they started, and for good reason. Because first up, we have the legendary Delay Spray. This is the MVP of lasting longer and keeping those eager penile nerves in check. You just do a quick spray, and you're set to outlast even the longest days of summer, ensuring the party doesn't end before you want it to. So you can have the mind-blowing climax you're now so very well equipped to reach, thanks to Promescent. It just helps you last longer without all the worry. And for women, Promescent's warming arousal gel is a fun pre-sex ritual. You just rub it into your vulva a few minutes before and you'll feel it start to tingle, warming up every nerve ending. So you'll feel that much more pleasure everywhere before you even get going. So it's kind of like the sure thing. So make sure this summer is the sexiest one yet. Check out promescent.com/Emily and get 15% off at checkout. You get free shipping, 60-day money-back guarantee, discreet shipping, all the things. Promescent is your ticket to a more guaranteed good time. That's PROMESCENT.com/Emily. Promescent.com/Emily for your exclusive discount. Check it out. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to Sex with Emily. On today's show, I'm speaking with my colleague and friend, Dr. Ian Kerner. Our discussion takes place in his New York City office, accented with real city sounds like low-frequency jackhammers, outside construction, and even the humming of the air conditioning. For the past 12 years, we've always prioritized superior sound quality and content for each podcast. However, I think what we covered in this in-depth interview is way too important not to share with you because of a little background noise. Some of the core themes that Dr. Kerner and I discussed: sexual clitoracy, how clitorate are you? The discourse of intercourse, ways in which couples can explore relationship models other than monogamy, understanding core erotic themes, and interesting evolutions and changes that Dr. Kerner has seen throughout his career. All this and more. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Look into his eyes. They're the eyes of a man obsessed by sex. Eyes that mock our sacred institutions. Bedroom eyes, they call them in a bygone day.
Hey, Emily, you got a boyfriend?
Because my man E here, he just got his heart broken. He thinks you're kind of cute.
A girl's
got
to have her standards. Oh, my.
Do women know about shrinkage?
Isn't it common knowledge?
What do you mean, like laundry? It shrinks?
Can we not talk about sex so much?
Are you kidding me?
Oh, my God, it feels so good.
Being bad feels pretty good.
But you know, Emily's not the kind of girl you just play with.
You're listening to Sex with Emily. We're talking about sex, relationships, and everything in between. For more information, go to sexwithemily.com where you can easily subscribe to our podcast. Check out the amazing website, our blogs that we update every single day to help you have better sex and relationships. And you guys, Alternative Sex Month is not over yet. You've got till the end of August, August 31st at midnight to apply. So what's Alternative August? Well, we're going to celebrate you and how you've moved outside your comfort zone. Like, have you explored new things, new sensations? You know, maybe for you, being alternative is that you just start talking about sex with your partner. You open up a new dialogue about things that you want to try, you know, things that make you feel great about yourself. places you want to explore with your partner, or even, you know, with your own sex life. Hey, you know, masturbation is sex with someone you love. All you have to do is email your story to feedback@sexwithemily.com, and we're going to pick four winners who will receive amazing prize packs. And we can't wait to hear from you. Again, August 31st at midnight is the deadline. Also, you guys, follow me on social media. I love hearing from you. You can follow me on Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, and Twitter. It's all at Sex with Emily. And we keep it safe for work, you guys. So don't be bashful. Don't be ashamed. Follow us. We love that. And I really think you're all going to enjoy the show. I know I enjoyed the interview and really getting in depth with Dr. Kerner. I'm so excited to share it with you. And I can't wait to hear what you think of the show. So you can always email me and let me know. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for listening. Hi, okay. We do need therapy.
I'm not usually sitting here, so it's always interesting to like see what the patients see.
This is actually good for you, I would think. Yeah. The perspective. I could do a little mini therapy on you. I'm with Dr. Ian Kerner. I'm sitting here in his office, his infamous office. I think it's infamous because very well-known licensed marriage and family therapist, sex therapist, New York Times best-selling author of She Comes First. Hi, Ian.
Hi, Emily.
I'm glad to be here in your office.
It's nice to have you. I hope that they're doing some work on the facade of the building. You know, it's one of these old West Village
buildings.
So,
have you been in this office for a while?
You know, not that long. About 18 months. I was in Soho before this.
Okay.
But I like it here.
Yeah, I like it too. I was just thinking like if these walls could talk. I mean, how long have you been practicing?
Close to about 20 years.
Okay. 20 years.
Yeah.
That's a lot of people that have come through. Mostly couples. Where did this all begin for you?
It all began back in my own childhood and college with my own sexual issues and dysfunctions and fears and anxieties. And there we go. Right on time. Hasn't been doing that for the last 2 hours, but that's New York.
Yeah,
it's called
fine.
New York luck. And I think that that always opened up a desire for me to feel at ease in the world and to normalize my own insecurities and issues.
Yeah, those insecurities when you were a teenager. Was it teenager you said? High school?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, really in all of my early sexual interactions with women, I suffered from premature ejaculation and I felt very embarrassed and ashamed and humiliated and kind of sexually crippled or sexually disabled. There was no internet. There were no men's magazines. There were no easy-to-read books. There was just Alfred Kinsey and Masters and Johnson and Helen Singer Kaplan and studies and technical data. And I sort of had to make my way through that to kind of come through to some sort of experience. But I was with a girlfriend at the time, and she thought, well, this is the sort of thing that we could talk about with a therapist, because I also had so much anxiety and I didn't really even know how to talk about the issues. So it wasn't just the experience, it was that I didn't have the words to match my internal experience or the vocabulary. So we went to see a therapist, and it didn't save the relationship, it didn't save me, but it started a process of communication and sort of opening a valve. Everything sort of unfolded from there. And here I am sitting on the other side, talking to lots of men with the same issue, lots of women with different issues, lots of couples.
Because here's the thing, when you said you had PE as a child, you were what, 17, 18?
Yeah.
For a few years, like until college?
No, through, I mean, PE is, it's a manageable condition, but it's not a cure. So I would say even up into the present, I mean, it's something that I'm conscious of, something that I'm aware of, something that I'm mindful of. You can take an SSRI to sort of delay ejaculation, but there is no...
But there's side effects and...
Yeah, there are side effects. There's no cure. This is a managed condition that involves cognitive and behavioral interventions. It involves insight. It involves sexual creativity. It involves empathy with a partner and the ability to communicate with a partner. Right. It involves a lot.
I understand that's a managed condition, obviously, and I thank you for being so open and honest about this. I know you've talked about it before, I'm sure, but I feel like so many
of my listeners can completely relate to this. So many men that listen to the show, and women. Wow. And the fact that saying that it's managed, because you always, oftentimes you hear people say, well, I had it and I don't anymore. I think it just maybe depends on the person and your conditions. Yeah. But it is something that, but I always say, like, going through it to people, it is a practice. Like, it's, if you just, let's say you, we talk about edging or we talk about different things mm-hmm. you can do, you can't just stop doing it. Like, if you stop, the condition will come back.
Absolutely.
So you were on my show recently. You called in. I'm so glad to be sitting here with you. And we talked about She Comes First. And I think I actually got in trouble. Nah, just kidding. But no, but they were like, you really love that book. Like, you love him. You love, I'm like, I'm obsessed with She Comes wow. First. It's amazing. I talk about it all the time. I'm like, okay, I won't talk about it as much as time. But that book really was, I'm just going to say it now, if you missed that show, but it was groundbreaking. I mean, I do talk about it on my show all the time. Like, every man should read it. Women, like, there's mm-hmm. so much useful information in there. But was that really, when in that book was, you just had your 10-year anniversary, or is it 20? Of She Comes First. I should know this. Was it your...
Well, I was practicing as a sex therapist, got certified, and then that book came out of clinical experience and personal experience and was kind of the culmination of a first chapter.
Right. What year did it come out?
2003.
Right. Okay. So like 15 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the anniversary. Through your practice, you were just sitting here thinking, God, these guys don't know. Women are complaining. Like, what? I mean, there's so many things you could write about. You're an expert in so many of these issues that people come in and talk about.
So why did I pick that issue?
I don't know, yeah.
Well, because it was personal to me, because I really believed that, you know, men needed to be enlightened in the area of sexual clitoracy. Today, we talk a lot more about the clitoris.
Right.
And we have books by Emily Nagoski Debbie Herbenick and... There's so many, and articles in Men's Health, but there was nothing really at the
time.
Nothing.
That was like, that's why it's so groundbreaking.
And I think that we were all living under the shadow of what I call the intercourse discourse, and men believing that the main way to satisfy a partner is through intercourse and wanting to have the hardest possible penis that could last as long as possible.
Pounding weight or with a jackhammer.
That was my goal for a while, too.
Right. And everyone goes, they still go through this.
You know,
some
and
men never learn.
And right. And you can have the hardest penis and you can last as long as you want to
and
last.
You suck in bed still if
and
you don't
still
make a comfort.
And you suck in bed.
Right. And you will suck in
and
bed.
And a lot of women who felt, well, what's wrong with me too? Like, right. Why isn't I, shouldn't I be having these vaginal orgasms? Shouldn't I be having these intercourse-based orgasms? So I felt that both men and women were kind of hobbled by this intercourse discourse. And so I wanted to kind of start to dismantle that.
That's why everyone needs to read it.
And I wonder if I even focused a little too much on oral sex. I mean,
no,
although...
No, it's the chapter. Okay. Can I just tell you that if it's the chapter that every man should read and woman, well, you just want to even understand your own body to be able to explain right. it to a partner, because I think a lot of women don't right. even know how to explain what they want.
Right.
But anyway, I think it is the most detailed, specific... useful chapter on oral sex I may have
well,
ever
it's the
read.
Whole book.
Right,
I mean,
right.
really half the book, two-thirds
well,
of the book.
Right.
And I guess for me, oral sex, going down on a woman, was so important, not only because it gave me a kind of feeling of mastery and ability and dexterity that I completely lacked with my penis, but it's also such a vulnerable, connecting, deep, intimate experience. And I still talk to so many women who wonder, do guys like this? Is it taking too long? What are they thinking, smelling, tasting? And a lot of men who still approach it as sort of nice to do, not a must have, something that's sort of a chore. And I really think that they're missing out on like a zen, mindful, connected
yeah.
experience.
How do you teach that? I mean, I try to teach that. But it's true. I think that there's a lot of men who are just, yeah, they're like, it's not my thing. I can't do it.
Right.
Because it takes focus. They feel like they don't want to fail at it. Whoever
right.
doesn't. So I think it's an important message.
But I sometimes feel that for better or for worse, and really it's only for better with She Comes First, because the techniques are so detailed and I am so passionate about oral sex. Sometimes I'm a little frustrated because it's just labeled an oral sex book.
I think of it as the orgasm book. I mean, really, like, you, She Comes First, like, even just the title is amazing. But I always feel like it becomes part of my, like, remember, She Comes First, you know? I mean, it's just, it's a thing and it's true. you could write it today, what else would you put in there? What would you have added or taken away?
Well, it's interesting. A colleague of mine, have you come across this new book called Being Clitorate by Lori Mintz?
Yes.
Okay, so it's a new book. It just came out. She actually is very lovely and refers to me, and she comes first. But she's really just focused kind of the clitoracy and the importance of thinking clitorally as mm-hmm. opposed to vaginally, and all of the possible ways of being clitorate and thinking clitorally. And I think that she's sort of out there with that message in a kind of very essential way.
Right.
That I feel like I do with She Comes First, often.
But that was your own voice at the time. I don't think it's a different way of saying it. Maybe she's just the clitoris.
Well, you know what's interesting too, Emily, is that I really wrote She Comes First before the renaissance of the sex toy. You know, right?
Yeah.
Like 2003.
Interesting, right?
Writing it in 2001, you did not walk into Babeland to have 100 beautifully crafted vibrators.
It was a different world then. I started 12 years ago, sex toys were not what they are now.
Right.
So it's been an explosion. So then you're like, you got your tongue, you got your fingers,
right.
Hands.
So I feel like, yes, you have your hands, you have your tongue, you have your penis, which you can use much more clitorally, and you have this whole new world of fantastic sex toys that are out there.
Yeah. Do you like sex toys?
I do. I love them. I don't really use them a lot in my own personal sex life. I mean, I've been with one woman for 20 years and we have figured out what works and we enjoy it, but I love sex toys.
Right.
I mean, I would love to use more of them in my own sex life.
But you
I
could
really
just
would.
Because here's the thing. I don't think this is the thing that people... I've been talking about this a lot lately, personally and professionally, and that people are like, it's sort of like a cop-out to use a toy, or it's not a natural orgasm if it doesn't happen, you know, with like PV sex. And I'm like, well, sometimes it can happen though, but it doesn't mean it's taking away from it. It's like if you want to have ice cream one night, you have chocolate ice cream, you love it. And then sometimes you're like, let's have some sprinkles. Is that actually better? Just different. Mm-hmm. It's a variety. And I feel like we've come a long way in the sense of 12 years ago when I started, and maybe when you started 20 years ago, it was like you had to say like to men all the time, they were so intimidated by toys that like, it's not going to take over for you. Like it can't go to the movies. It can't.
Right.
But now, but there's still, so it's not as much of that, but it's still
although
like
a lot
this,
of men still believe
they
that.
Do. They do.
A lot so of men, like I mean, I'm working with a couple, like they are breaking up because she has not been orgasmic for a whole duration of a marriage. And she actually, early in the marriage, introduced a vibrator into the sex play, and it was really helping, and he didn't like it. He didn't like that he felt threatened by it.
Right. So how do you talk to men? I mean, I'm sure they're getting separated for other, breaking up for other reasons.
Yes.
Maybe not. Or maybe, well.
Well, I mean.
Orgasm, not having.
I mean, I'm really known as a sex therapist, and so. That's kind of the issue that people are coming in with. And so.
So it is. So he's like, she can't use his
vibrator.
Well,
now he would love for her to bring a vibrator back in, but it's too late.
Too much water in the brain, right? Too much time. I mean, can you ever see a couple the first time you're like, this is done? Like, you know, like the Gottman theory, the test, like looking at couples with like contempt and the way they speak to each other.
Well, if it was really done, they wouldn't be here.
True.
You know, if it was really done. They may come in thinking it's done, but if it was really done, they probably wouldn't be sitting here. And my job isn't necessarily to undo what's done. Sometimes getting undone has taken so much work and so much self-reflection and so much courage. It's important that it stays undone.
You mean like if they came in because of a crisis or an affair or sex, anything that's been going on? That's
sure.
what got him here.
You know, what about a relationship where one woman has really had to exile a sexual part of herself for a whole marriage? It's not really only her husband or her partner's fault. It's her fault as well. They own the relationship together, but a sexual part of her in this relationship just never really came alive in the way that she wanted it to, or something that was alive became exiled, and...
You mean the orgasm? Never came alive. Are you saying in general?
In general.
Whole host
in general. In general. See,
thinking,
that's a problem as a therapist. You get too general.
Yeah, too general. I'm like, let's get into the orgasm. No, it's not a problem. Know. It's amazing. But I know, I'm just thinking about how... I always say, you know, we're responsible for our own orgasms. And so I was still hearing the woman sitting here going, I've never had one.
But I could be with a... So that couple can be here... and she could really have made a decision that she's ready to leave or wants to leave or wants to open up the relationship or really do something structurally different. And that partner may be hearing this for the first time or really getting it, has heard it 100 times, but is really getting it for the first time, you know.
Because of the presence of a therapist being here,
I think. The presence of a therapist, yes, very often.
Whatever.
Hearing it more seriously, maybe they're separated or she left or they just haven't been sexual in a very, very long time. It's not necessarily my job to keep them together.
Right. No. Yeah, I mean, I know you're probably not going to say this has got to be done. I'm sure there have been times when you've said that. But no, I get it. Just have a place for them. I mean, that's why I say every couple, I think, needs therapy. Like a maintenance. I feel like your car needs a checkup. Yeah. And every single couple on the planet needs therapy. And I don't even know why people still... Right. Do you want... Well, we're on your couch. Do you want me to go sit at your desk? I could try. I'd be so nervous. Be like cooking for like some kind of... I can't cook either. I don't know what I can do. Now we're going to take a quick break and give a shout out to our sponsors. Thank you for supporting them and for supporting the show. We'll be right back. There's nothing quite like sinking your teeth into a good sandwich. But listen, carb guilt is real. I'm someone who's very invested in my health, and I like to get my carbs from oats and beans and fruits and not bread. But I love bread. So here's my hack. Thanks to Hero Bread, you can enjoy your favorite bready delights without the carb consequences. Hero Bread has turned those carby, empty calorie bread products into fluffy, delicious breads that boast 0 to 1 net carbs per serving, 0 grams of sugar, and are packed with loads of fiber and protein. The first time I tried their white bread, I was skeptical. Could it really taste good with such impressive nutritional stats? Well, I'm pleasantly surprised to say it absolutely does. The texture is just phenomenal. It's like this soft, airy, and it just toasts up like a dream. I've whipped up everything from grilled cheese to PB&J and even made enchiladas, wraps, and tacos with their tortillas. Each time, Hero Bread has been a game changer. And here's the kicker. Despite its light texture and great taste, Hero Bread fits perfectly into my health goals. It's been adding more fiber to my diet while keeping the sugar at bay. Whether I'm packing a picnic lunch, planning a road trip snack, which I often do, or prepping French toast for breakfast, Hero Bread is my go-to. So whether you're craving a classic sandwich, a burger, or a hearty bun, or even indulging in a low net carb croissant, Hero Bread is something for everyone. And I highly recommend checking their monthly small batch drops out so you can try goodies like the 1 gram net carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit and so much more. You won't believe what they have. So you ready to kick carb guilt to the curb? Head over to hero.co and snag 10% off your order with the code Emily. That's Emily at hero.co. Going back to, you said opening up. I wanted to talk to you about opening up relationships. So non-monogamy, alternative relationships, polyamory. There's so many different ways to talk about open relationships right now. There's a million different ways. Configurations of it. But, you know, that's probably been coming up again, probably for 20 years. But I feel like in the last 5 to 10 years, more and more so, maybe even more and less few, people are like, oh, it's really an option. It really can work for couples. But then there's sex relationship therapists who think, no, that could never happen. If that happens, your relationship's over. It's going to be a disaster. What do you see? Have you helped couples navigate this? I'm sure you do.
I do. I think that there are more options than ever for couples that are normalized and can be mirrored in their lives by other couples. And these are really exciting options. I mean, it's, you know, beyond just what you can do on your own in the privacy of your own bedroom with your partner. There are really opportunities to be more sexually adventurous together, to go to sex parties, to swing, to bring in other partners, to engage in some form of consensual non-monogamy where you may have play partners or experiences on the side, to, you know, more full-blown polyamory. There is a wealth of options. And I'm always surprised about who goes for it and who doesn't. I just put stuff out there as options.
Do you ever, so you put it out there to couples?
I put it out there as a menu of possible choices to reflect upon. When you come into this office,
now tell me,
you get an opportunity to throw a lot against the wall, to reflect, to risk a little bit of vulnerability in terms of what you want to say, but nothing has to be linked to a behavior or an action. Everything that's happening in this room is just reflection. And so if a couple is really stuck in their sex life and my mind starts going to some version of sexual adventurousness shared or some version of consensual non-monogamy, I'll just put it out there as, I'm not saying it's for you, but here's a few different options that couples have pursued. What do you think?
Right. And they're probably like, oh, no. I mean, there must be such a range of like...
I have been shocked. So sometimes clearly you get that a couple is hungering for this and has something in their DNA that makes them ripe for this. But I recently was working with a couple, that traditional couple, married, professional careers, had some serial monogamy before that, a couple of kids now, really tuned out, not really listening to each other, not sexual anymore, a whole range of symptoms that come from being disconnected. And they came in ready to separate, really ready to separate, very painful, very depressing session. About halfway through, I was like, well, before you separate, I just wonder, have you ever considered any of these other structural dynamics that might allow you to not just quit on each other right now? And I just put them out there, and I did not expect any of them to take.
Right.
And they came back about a month later. I thought that they were done and separated. We settled up their last bill, everything. And they came back saying that they really took to heart the session. There was, this isn't so long ago, there was that article in the New York Times that was out about open relationships, and they've been trying it, and they're together.
Right, exactly. I mean, this is the thing. I think that's amazing to hear
from
you.
And it's incredibly fraught, and it isn't easy, and it's creating a lot of new conflicts and a lot of new friction, but they're trying it.
But better than the old friction, maybe.
Yeah.
It's a new friction. It still has that novelty, the newness, not the same goddamn issues, right? Because I think it's interesting because I think that monogamy is hard, non-monogamy is hard. There's struggles in all of it. And in a way, it's almost like they're taking on a new, you know, we say couples should take on a new activity together, learn something new together. Yeah. They're kind of learning non-monogamy together. And even though it's stressful and they're getting that sexual
And I really think that a couple of years ago, even a year ago, they would have gone straight to separation and eventually divorce. They may still go to separation and divorce, but they will have gone off the monogamy highway. They will have gone off road, off map, you know, and given something different a whirl.
Right. Because why not? So do you have couples that come in here and you actively are helping them, like work on a
absolutely. Set the boundaries now, some couples come in, that's specifically the work that they want to do.
Okay.
Start talking about it, adjust it, figure it out, launch it, relaunch it. Lots of couples come in now, and that's sort of the centerpiece of the agenda.
So how did you learn about this? 20 years ago, would you have talked about this? When did it start becoming more of your practice?
Well, I mean, it's become much more of my practice in the last, honestly, the last 2 to 3 years.
Right? So you feel like there's kind of been a tipping point.
Yeah, because I feel that there's many more options for couples. And again, there's much more mirroring.
What do you mean by that?
Well, that there's more people in society doing it that look like ample reflections of who you are.
Yeah. People think, it's ponytail guy. You know, Men is my sometimes co-host. Yeah. Like, oh, it's a guy with a ponytail and they're swinging through and drugs. And
I feel like more young people are also like sort of graduating from college or launching into the world with a more fluid, non-binary, just a more fluid approach to life and relationships and sexuality and gender in general. So I feel like it sort of was a bunch of sort of stuff waiting to happen. I mean, I think it's very helpful that there are, at least here in New York, so many amazing sex parties that you can go to that don't feel like sleazy per se.
What goes on? Tell me about the ones here that people, have you been to them?
I don't go to them myself.
No, you couldn't. You'd be
And then what am I, if I run into a patient?
They'd be like, selfie? Right. Like, no, please don't post this on Instagram. That is true. I mean, they have them, I guess, all over. Well, no, there's a lot of places, though, where I get like emails from listeners like in the middle of wherever. Yeah. And I'm like, I don't know if there's a sex party in that town in Kansas or not. But you could create one. But it's interesting because I feel like that now it really is an option and that people, more people are asking about it and taking to it. Is there a couple that would come in here? Or what kind of couple would you say would not be right for it? You'd be like, absolutely not. This couple could not handle non-monogamy.
I don't know, Emily. I don't want to say for sure because I would have said a couple that's under tremendous stress and pressure, but,
but you've seen it all.
But I've seen that couple come in ready to break up where one partner doesn't want to break up. You know, I've seen couples that have been extremely rigid and conservative in how they approach
amazing, right?
sexual relationships. So I don't
there is
really...
Not, I like
I've seen people who are both adventurous and are just looking, you know, they both share different types of adventurous experiences and peak experiences. And this is just an area that they haven't mm-hmm. ventured down yet in pursuing peaks. But I guess at this point, I don't have any clear
rules. I'm just curious if there's anything. I think it's healthy not to have
this. I don't want somebody to feel pressured into it. I don't want somebody to feel like they have to. Now, I have worked with couples where one partner feels very, very strongly about it and really wants to try swinging or being in an open relationship or has a particular vision of what an open relationship looks like. And the other partner is going along for the ride and is in the passenger seat and is trying to make it work, but really just isn't happy.
And you can tell yes. those people are not on board.
Yes, that person looks dispirited right. and drained.
Have you seen couples come in where they were like that, but then eventually they come around? I'm sure you've seen all iterations of this. Yeah. I always say the same thing. Yeah, if they're not on the same page, you can't force your partner to do it, but people come around.
I was working for a long time. I don't know if you call it a triple or a thruple, but, you know.
Thruple. I love it, yeah.
A thruple. But yeah, they were polyamorously together, knew each other, and constantly renegotiating the rules of non-monogamy. And one person who was the secondary wanted to be the primary, kind of became the primary, and then the other primary decided they needed a secondary, but then the secondaries didn't like being secondaries and needed primaries. And so the whole thing just like expanded and expanded
right.
until, believe it or not, at the end, I just ended up working with two of them as a couple.
Right.
And so they worked their way actually to monogamy.
Right. That's so interesting. It was just
from
too
total
much.
Polyamory right. and non-monogamy to like, monogamy.
Right, because it's kind of like there are no rules to it. We get to make our own rules. Do you think that monogamy should be the only like kind of legal union on the table? We're not meant to be monogamous.
No, you know, actually, I really do. I do believe in the power of the pair bond, and I do. I think it's certainly socially conditioned. But I think it's probably genetically conditioned as well. And I mean, I think that there's a lot of power to the pair bond. I have a very, personally, I mean, and I don't ever try and use, although I was writing She Comes First, beginning with personal experience, and I do often look and locate myself in these situations. I don't try and map my own, what I'm doing onto any of my patients or anybody, but I think I've experienced a very powerful pair bond
right.
that's lasted 20 years, and I don't envision it, you know.
Right, of course it's possible. I'm just saying for a lot of the patients that you see, you know, do you just feel like sometimes, I feel like now it is a different time because people think, oh, it can't, it's not just this crazy notion
right.
of your neighbors who are swinging
right.
and having key parties. It actually can be a lifestyle for people that are working in that monogamy, like I said, just as much of a struggle as non-monogamy.
Well, what do you think about it?
Yeah, I think, it's a good question. I do think that it should be more of an option. I like talking about it on the show, and I like when people see healthy examples of it and having
right.
couples on that show that it does work, because I believe that there's a lot of voices out there, a lot of people respect in our space that are like, no, it could never work. Not many of them left,
right.
but who think it could never work or it's not right or it'll tear a relationship apart, which can't be true if you don't handle it correctly. But yeah, I don't know. I think a lot of it does have to do with your, you know, maybe how you're wired, your DNA.
Yeah. What I don't like is sometimes though when a couple comes in and one partner is more sexually adventurous, wants to open up the relationship, maybe even wants to leave the relationship, and the other partner who's more conservative really relies on marriage as an institution or as a definition. You are a wife.
Okay.
I am a husband.
This
is a marriage. And that's supposed to give that a privilege in the room. A husband, a wife, a marriage. And I don't like that. I don't like when somebody's just using the language, the discourse of sort of
some like sort just of because we got married, model. That's the way it should right. be, right? No, I get. Right. It. I think there's a lot of challenges around it. I would just like people to see that there's other options. Whatever works for them, they get to define the rules of their own relationship. So when couples come in and they have like conflicts with their not mismatched libidos, but more like what turns them on, like erotic desire. Mm-hmm. How do you work with couples, like kind of mapping that out? I know that's like a huge question, but I just feel like we talk so much about communication and how do you sit down and talk to your partner about these different desires that you have? I mean,
yeah,
I know there's not like a tool. I wish there was a quick fix, but what works?
Well, I think in general, couples have often developed a physical vocabulary of actions that result in a sexual experience that either works or doesn't work. And they have not developed a verbal or psychological vocabulary to the same level of sophistication. Right. So they are going through a series of physical actions, sometimes with no discussion, no talk, no psychogenic stimulation. And so I absolutely believe that psychogenic stimulation, the ability to think your way through arousal, the ability to fantasize your way through arousal, is extremely important and extremely powerful. And I know that, I believe that wholeheartedly. I've seen that in my own relationship. I went from somebody who was afraid to utter a word during sex. I wouldn't have been able to comment on my partner's body or on my body or what I was noticing in their reactions or in my reactions, to not only developing a comfort with that and finding, wow, it's so reaffirming and assuring to be able to just praise and communicate and talk and engage that language, to actually being able to risk a bit of my own core erotic themes and the things that turn me on, to share that with a partner and open up a fantasy world, an entire fantasy world that's purely imagination, where the actual sex itself doesn't change at all.
Right.
But the psychological context around the sex is so vulnerable and exciting and risk-taking.
Yeah.
And so I really believe that that is part of the key to a long-lasting, sexually fulfilled relationship, is being able to open up that psychogenic dimension.
Talk about that. So the core erotic theme, figuring out what turned you both on. So let's say couples, right?
That's part of it, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, I love the core. I mean, I've been talking a lot about the core erotic theme and that fantasy is such an important part of relationships. You've couples in here, I'm sure, from all different stages of that. One has more of an active fantasy life, the other one doesn't. But what kind of like homework do you give couples, or assignments, or how do you, what if they're like, I have none, I don't have any fantasy, I don't even know where to start? What would you tell them?
Well, I'll often, you know, go through a menu of possible fantasies.
Do you have like a list?
Yeah, I mean, I'll start like talking spanking, about submission, title. Domination, voyeurism, exhibitionism. I'll turn them on to a lot of progressive porn sites.
What do you recommend? Tell me progressive porn sites that you tell them.
I love a lot of the female directors.
Right.
So Erica Lust and Jackie St. James, mm-hmm, and some of the sites.
I'm just curious if anything. I'm just curious if anything comes to mind. You like go home and like.
I like the porn that you pay for.
Yeah.
I like the porn.
Kink.com.
Kink.com.
Where else do you pay these days?
What's that?
I'm trying to think of where. I just know Kink from San Francisco.
Well, the reason I like the porn that you pay for is because generally the porn that you're getting then are from artists who really
care
about what they're doing, who
female directors
are more committed to the theme of what they're doing, who aren't just chasing advertising and clicks by just showing
body parts.
There's stories, there's narratives, there's bodies that look realer and are more authentic. So many of the people that I work with who complain about porn just complain about how boring it is and how it just all starts to just look the same.
It does, because they're not, right, they're not searching. I think that's a good point. I talk about a lot of the things you mentioned, but really, you're right. Like, it's kind of like if you have to pay for it, you get what you pay for. And so it could actually be a great tool for couples to learn together. I mean, absolutely. We talk about that a lot. That's so interesting.
I was working with a couple, and just the theme of like comic books came up and superheroes, and like she gradually got to reveal, she would never have revealed this, that she had like a Supergirl fantasy.
Wow.
And she wanted to be dominated, and she wanted her partner to pretend to be a supervillain who had kryptonite, who would like knock her unconscious with the kryptonite.
Amazing.
And take her. And then they used Halloween as a way of like, she got the Supergirl costume and the boots and the cape, and it was fantastic for them. It was like led to mind-blowing sex because she was really tapping into a core erotic theme, which was interesting too. She had also had a history of being sexually assaulted in college and feeling very powerless in that situation. And so the idea of being, I guess, of being Supergirl, of being a strong woman, but still being able to take an experience that had been very powerless and painful and transform it through pleasure was very rich for her.
That is rich for trauma. If you can do that, people who've suffered trauma, that if you can kind of turn it around and use it towards your sexual, sure you do amazing work that around that. A lot of, God, I just think everyone needs sex therapy. They do.
Sometimes people are like, oh, I have this fantasy or I have this fetish. Like, why? I need to get to the bottom of it. And I think that that automatically pathologizes it in a certain way. You don't need to know the why.
Right.
But sometimes there is a why. And sometimes getting to the why is really interesting and fascinating. I was just going to say, I had a patient who came in with a very sort of rigid fetish around sleep fantasies, like somnophilia, like the idea of making love or having sex with women who were unconscious. And clearly, like, we know this from the Bill Cosby stuff.
Right.
And he had never crossed those lines, although he had had some weird sort of like drunken blackout type sexual experiences that were a little scary for him. So he pushed up against the hard boundaries of this, and he was dispirited and scared about it and just felt, you know, I'm never going to have the right partner and I'm always doomed to repeat this. And even if he found a partner who was sort of game to explore this fantasy, they would get bored of it. And anyway, like, we tried, I mean, I worked for months and months around just exploring it and examining it and trying different things. And then eventually, like, a childhood memory emerged that had never come up for him in years, where he grew up in a home with a single mother who worked, I think, 6 days a week, 17 hours a day. Her only day off was Sundays. But by Sunday, he would wake up at like 7 a.m. excited to spend time with his mother, and she would be dead asleep, and he would try and wake her up and tickle her and be with her and just wanted the attention of his mom. And she would just say, go away. And she wouldn't, I mean, the poor woman was working 6 days a week. Like, she couldn't get out of bed until about noon. And he just got there and just broke down in tears with this memory. And it just became clear that this was some kind of reenactment of that early experience, some attempt
to get love,
to take that pain that had been dissociated and experience something through pleasure and through some kind of mastery.
And after understanding that, did he still have that same urge to have that?
It became loosened up.
Right. Wow. Those are the moments, though. Yeah. You're like, that's why I do this show, seriously, I think that's such a breakthrough after working for you for months.
It was. And it's not that the fantasy or the theme went away, but it was able to soften up enough so that other types of fantasies and themes could emerge.
I think when we connect those dots, and that's why I love therapy. Literally walking in here, I got so excited. We were sitting in the lobby. I was like, I just love therapy. I just want to lay it out. No, I seriously love being in therapy, but it's true. Like those moments when you have these connections.
This is an old school therapy building.
I know. That's
probably
the thing.
Like therapists on every floor. There's probably about 500 therapists in this
Do you think I should just go knock and see if anyone's available? Like, I've kind of jonesy here in New York. I need a little therapy. No, but that's, I mean, it is kind of the old school with the white noise.
Speaking of therapy, I have another session.
Okay, we
got to
go. Okay, no, you're awesome.
Soon.
No, we're going to wrap up. we're out of time. Is that what you say to a therapist? We're out of time. Like when you hit your breakthrough, I hate when they do that.
We have to stop for today.
Stop for today. Usually when I'm just about to break through, like, we have to stop. Do you bring a check? Okay, I have one more question for you, though, but you can answer quickly. My final question for you is, after years of doing this, would we say 20? What would you say is the main thing that has changed if there's anything that you've seen, like this shift, I know we talked about polyamory. Is there anything that you think, wow, that's just around when I started? Like toys we talked about.
Yeah, toys. Anything else? Consensual non-monogamy.
Hasn't come up.
Well, a lot more kink. And a lot more kink from a kind of like a pansexual perspective of like, hey, maybe this is not exactly my orientation, but almost an orientation.
Right.
And so seeing like different new types of sexual orientations that don't fit neatly into straight or gay.
Right.
And that are thematically driven.
Right. Good answer. It's an exciting time to be a human and having sex. Thank you so much, Ian Kerner.
Thank you, Emily.
Dr. Kerner, you're amazing. We'll have all your contact info. Is there anything else that you'd like to mention or people can find you on your website?
It's nice to see you in
New York.
It's
so nice to see you too. We'll wind you this forever. Thank you for taking time.
Absolutely.
And we have to stop now. Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much.